This is a Defocus Media production.
You only get one chance at a first impression. And for new contact lens wearers, that can be the difference between success or dropping out of lens wear altogether. Today's world is fast-paced and highly digital. In fact, young, new contact lens wearers average over 9 hours per day in front of screens. And during those hours, they are blinking 60% less often, which leads to more dryness and more eye fatigue. The Acuvue Oasys one-day contact lens design meets today's digital demands. In a recent clinical trial of daily disposable contact lens wearers who use digital devices 8 or more hours a day, Acuvue Oasys One Day was superior in comfort and reducing the symptoms of dryness versus other daily disposable contact lenses. When you make that initial lens selection for your patient, prescribe a lens that will set your patient up for success. We only get one chance to wow our patients by having them love their contact lenses from the very first fit. You can learn more about the Acuvue Oasys One Day family of products at acuvue.com.
Hey everybody, I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session. Thanks for joining again, everybody, and I am more than delighted and gratified by having a repeat guest, Dr. Marguerite McDonald, on the podcast. Thank you for joining me again, Marguerite.
My pleasure, Chris.
I really want to have the chance to learn about your esteemed career. You know, you are arguably the most famous ophthalmologist that I certainly have ever met myself, but arguably could be ever. And, you know, how does one get to where you are and have done the amazing things you've done? None of the things come easy, and life always tends to throw us obstacles and curveballs. And yet some of the things that you have been able to do are truly amazing. So, if you don't mind, can we just start at the beginning? And how did you decide on your career path, and how did you get started?
Well, I decided to be an eye doctor because of my own personal issues. My parents didn't realize how extremely myopic I was. And one day when I fell into a lake I didn't see, they realized that I'd better be rushed to the eye doctor. So they took me to the optometrist nearby who said, she's a high myope and she's going to be blind when she's an adult. So whoa. I was already -9 at age 5. And, I got my first pair of glasses, and I remember really seeing my mother's face for the first time and looking at the leaves. They were all up at the top of a tree. I didn't know that leaves belonged up there. I would find them on the ground and hold them up against my nose and look at them. And it was a revelation. And I tied those glasses on for 6 weeks. I wouldn't take them off. My mother had to bathe me around those glasses. And then the next big event, of course, they kept getting thicker and thicker and thicker. And as my myopia increased, then the next big event was in the state of Illinois, there used to be a law that you couldn't get contacts till you were 11. So on my 11th birthday, I'm back in the same optometrist's office and I'm getting fit with contacts, and they were polymethylmethacrylate soup bowls, but I was so thrilled. So I ran over to my best friend's home and I knocked on her door, and her older brother, who I've known forever, opens the door and says, "Is that you, Marguerite?" And I said, "Yes," with tears pouring down my face. He said, "Hey, do you want to go to the movies this Friday?" And I said, "Someday we're all going to see without glasses or contacts." if we want. So that's the truth. So I ended up being -11.
Okay. Well, it could have been worse.
I have someone in my practice who's -52. It could have been worse.
Oh, my goodness.
But anyway, you know, most dermatologists have bad skin. Most psychiatrists are a little crazy. So a lot of times your personal health issues guide you toward your career selection.
100%.
Yeah.
So you followed through, went to medical school. You already had the inclination of eyes. And so ophthalmology, you know, seemed to be a very logical progression based on your life experience that you just shared with us. How did you opt to determine where you wanted to specialize in the eyes?
So, you know, because of my refractive error, I was always interested in refractive surgery. And I ended up at LSU for my cornea fellowship. And at that time, the chairman was Herb Kaufman, who was the most famous cornea specialist in the world. He was on the cover of Time magazine when he was 28 for inventing the first antiviral drug in the world. People flew in on private jets from all over the world to have him operate on them. And it was an amazing experience. So right after I arrived, I was assigned to the 10-year dry eye project, but he had just started to work on something called epikeratophakia. And epikeratophakia is a contact lens made out of human corneal tissue that's been heavily processed and freeze-dried. And you grind in the prescription on a cryo lathe, and then it goes through a heavily, just a very intense series of processes to freeze-dry it and keep it sterile. And then it's shipped in a contact lens bottle to the doctor, who pours saline on it. It fluffs up and you sew it onto the cornea. So epikeratophakia was developed. So he said, listen, you're not on the dry eye project. He said, I just gave a big lecture about this at the American Academy of Ophthalmology and I'm under fire. It was the Jackson Memorial Lecture and I'm being criticized for talking about some new surgical technique with three patients who have 2 weeks of follow-up. You've got to be on this team. You've got to help me out here. So we developed it, and it was removable, reversible, repeatable. We developed it for aphakia. This is going back a while. IOLs were not very good at that time. They were producing UG syndrome, uveitis, glaucoma, hyphema. So we developed it for aphakia, high hyperopia, myopia, keratoconus. And it was unbelievable. Allergan made these things. So you would phone in your script. They would make a contact lens, you know, made of human corneal tissue, an epikeratophakia lenticule, and ship it to the doctor. And we would remove the central epithelium, make a tiny little groove in the periphery, and sew it into place. The results were unbelievably good. But it took 6 to 8 weeks for the lenticules to clear. And pretty soon, RK and other technologies made it obsolete, but it was a great introduction to refractive surgery. We taught thousands of doctors all over the world how to do it. And if you didn't like it, you peel it right off. So that was my intro. But while epikeratophakia was still being performed all over the world, the excimer laser started to be an issue because in 1983, Dr. Steve Troquel published his now classic paper where he took a laser that was used in Silicon Valley to make computer chips and he strafed it across a bunch of cadaver pig and cow eyes. And he said, look, there's no thermal damage to surrounding tissue. I wonder if we could use this, you know, maybe for refractive surgery. So I called him up. I was down in New Orleans now as an assistant professor. And I said, do you remember me, Dr. Troquel? We used to do research together in retinoblastoma when I was in medical school at Columbia. You need monkeys. You don't have them at Columbia. I know. I've got them. I'm down here in Louisiana. I've got thousands of monkeys at my disposal. So Steve Troquel, Charles Munnellan, and I began to work on the excimer. And you know, after research on plastic discs, then cadaver eyes, then living rabbits, then living monkeys, I had the honor of doing the first laser vision correction procedure in the world in March of 1988. And, you know, the rest is history, you know. And then 10 years later, Yanni Polikaris developed, of Crete, at University of Crete, he developed LASIK, because the speed of return of vision and the discomfort in the first week after PRK were were a lot for some people. Now,
sure.
I have since worked out a hang on one second. Steve, this is a podcast. They're recording it. Okay. So, okay. I am sorry. Sorry. background noise. So, he said, you know, if we make this flap, people will have faster return of vision and virtually no pain, which was the case. But PRK is still done around the world in large numbers. And I've worked out a regimen where people are just as comfortable and see just as well. I mean, the difference between LASIK and modern surface ablation as far as speed return of vision and pain is minimal, like hours different.
And what is done different? What do you do differently to reduce the pain?
So that I give them a gigantic dose of oral steroids. This is, of course, if they're healthy and not diabetic. They get a gigantic dose, 80 milligrams, a neurosurgical dose, exactly 30 minutes before the laser fires. And if you have a lot of steroid in your bloodstream, it makes all the difference in the world. And then I also give them Zantac, 150 mm-hmm. milligrams twice a day, because some people get an upset stomach with oral steroids. So they get 80 milligrams the first day, 80 the second day, then 40, 20, 10, 5, and in 6 days they're off, a rapid taper. This is magical. And also we give them, besides the usual, you know, antibiotics and steroid drops, they get comfort drops, quote unquote. And this is 0.1% tetracaine. Now, we all know you can't put 1% tetracaine or proparacaine on a corneal wound. It won't heal. But 0.1% does heal. And that's been proven in the scientific literature. A lot of studies were done at Moorfields Hospital in London on this. So it helps cut the pain when they're home and it doesn't slow their healing. And so there are a couple little things like that. I do have a PRK regimen that I can share. I put people on vitamin C. Vitamin C helps corneal healing. You know, I have a whole regimen, but they come in the first day post-op smiling, white eyes, no sunglasses. Wow. They're usually 20/25 on that day, and they rapidly go to 20/20 during the course of the first week.
That's fantastic.
So you
mentioned something.
Go ahead.
At some point, I want to know, I understand your pathway into medicine and your pathway into ophthalmology, but you mentioned your research at Columbia while you were a medical school student. And then obviously, you know, heading right to LSU, that had research endeavors with it as well. Was that always an inclination of yours to tie in research and discovery to your career, whereas others just solely do patient care?
It's always been interesting to me to try to move the ball forward. I love patient care. And all of us get these great ideas while we're taking care of our patients, but the next step is follow through, you know? And I was lucky at LSU, they were grateful to have clinician scientists there. At any university today, you eat what you kill. So if you decide to take one day a week to do research, mm-hmm. you will make a whole lot less money. And so, you know, that puts the pressure on young professors at universities. You know, you've got a family, you've got to feed them, you got to put them all in school. I mean,
right.
You know, but back then, we actually got paid for the day we did research. It wasn't as much as if we had spent it in the clinic, but we got paid.
Right.
And, you know, that I think that's really a shame, because I don't know of another university today that does that. I've checked out quite a few universities. If you decide to spend time during the workday doing research, you know, that's something you will have to accept a lower salary, significantly lower.
That's
so
unfortunate.
Sad. Yeah. So the days of the clinician scientist are almost over. The only way to escape that is to maybe get an endowed chair. But how many endowed chairs are there? And you certainly,
exactly.
You certainly won't get an endowed chair when you're a young assistant professor.
So did you have really quality, I mean, you already mentioned one renowned one, but did you have really high quality mentors to get you started through this endeavor and process?
I would say there was one, Dr. Herb Kaufman. He really stood out. There was someone who I admired greatly, who I considered a mentor when I was a resident. He was a 100% clinician, Dr. Sigmund Schutz, and he was a very well-known, well-respected ophthalmologist in Manhattan. And he didn't do research, but the way he cared for patients, the way he spoke to them, and every year he took the boards just to test himself. He didn't have to take them. He took the boards. And if he thought his score was a tiny bit less than perfect in one area, he would research that area to make sure next year when he took the boards. So, I mean, I just thought he was unbelievable in his devotion to high quality patient care. And Herb Kaufman, who was my fellowship director, was the ultimate clinician scientist, took great care of patients and had brilliant research ideas. You know, everybody would come at a problem in one direction and he'd come at it from 90 degrees away. You know, it was just amazing.
Fantastic. I love it. I may have interrupted you earlier. Were you leading us to some different information on the PRK story?
Oh, well, no, that just renewed my interest in all things refractive, which is one of the reasons why I am so excited about Vuity. Right. Which we talked about in another episode of your podcast, but, you know, to give people exquisite vision, help whatever it takes, drugs, drops, pills, surgery, whatever it takes, if you can do it safely and effectively, it gives me great joy. Just like when you take out a hand motion cataract and they're 20/25 the next day or 20/20, it's, you know, I always turn and I say, that's why I went to school. That's right there. That's why I went to school. And it's a joy.
So looking back over your years, is there anything you would have done differently?
I wish I still had the opportunity to do some laboratory research. I'm involved in clinical trials all the time, but I don't have that opportunity as I did back at LSU so long ago to actually do laboratory research. And that was fantastic. I loved that. And there's just not that opportunity now.
Right.
You know, and I think those opportunities, as I said, have almost disappeared for clinicians. Right. But, you know, if I could snap my fingers, I would convince a billionaire to set up a system so that universities would pay clinicians to spend one day a week at least doing research. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, we'd certainly make a lot more progress, probably a lot more swifter than we can today.
We sure would.
So before you did the first laser procedure on a human eye, how many thousands of plastics, as you mentioned, and monkeys and other animals, rabbits, do you think you've fired the laser at before human number one?
Oh, thousands. Thousands.
Thousands.
Yeah. If you look at all the plastic, and the stories along the way are really incredible. And so when we were doing rabbits are far more reactive to anything. If you take a cataract out of a rabbit perfectly, their eye will be 10 times as inflamed as if you took it out of a human. So in some ways, they're not the best model when you're testing surgical techniques. But hey, you know, we were moving up from plastic and cadaver eyes. And they don't have Bowman's membrane, by the way. So that's another difference. But the rabbits, we didn't realize back then that smoother ablations would turn out better. We didn't know. Nobody knew anything. So,
right.
So we had ablations. We would fire the laser at the rabbit. And the rabbit was, are you ready, 10 feet away? We'd fire at the rabbit, and then we would hand crank the diaphragm. So we'd shoot for a few seconds, crank, 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 close the diaphragm, like just like, you know, with a camera, shoot for another few seconds. So we had 5 steps on the ablations. And they had horrible, horrible scars. And 1 week, my cornea fellow, who was assigned to help me, and my research director both quit and said, this project is going nowhere. Oh, adios. My. So there were some down times. And then we got the idea, you know, before we give up completely, let's try a model more like our human eye. So we moved to monkeys where things were much, much different. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing was, when we got finally, you know, we figured out how to improve the ablation profile, et cetera, but we got to humans and we were doing the human blind eye trial. And we finally got to move the laser out of the primate center in Covington, Louisiana, across Lake Pontchartrain, and we put it in the medical center. But The dean was afraid we'd kill everyone with a gas leak. So we were out in a little trailer, and the trailer was next to the trash compactor for the university. So we'd be starting to operate, and all of a sudden our trailer would shake, 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 because the trash compactor was in operation. And I was so upset. I would run out and tell them to stop. You know, we're operating here. They wouldn't stop. Right. I went to the dean. I went everywhere. And finally, I said, I'm going to show them. I'm going to look at the people who were operated upon while the trailer was shaking and when it wasn't.
Of course.
I analyzed the data. The patients that were operated while the trailer was shaking did better. So that's how we realized how critical it was to make smooth ablations, because the eye would gently rock just the tiniest bit and it would smooth out and buff out the ablation profile. So, you know, there are all these funny little things along the way that happen serendipitously that move the ball forward, and, you know,
crazy,
also crazy and great.
It's the science of discovery in a random world.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Oh, truly amazing. So what's next for you? What do you see in your next 5 to 10 years?
So I would love to think of a way to continue patient care, but get back to some research, even if I give up income for a day. I think I'm going to do that because I love it so much. That's what I see in my future. I've got to figure out exactly how to do it.
Right.
But I would so love that. That was the best part of my life. One day a week, you know, working with the PhDs, the laser scientists, PhDs in physiology, my own husband, Dr. Steve Kleiss, who was the inventor of modern corneal topography, the color-coded contour maps. He was a part of our team. It was just so exciting. And then to see finally, you know, what you've done come to fruition in the clinic, is the greatest joy on earth.
Yeah, I mean, literally lives have changed given the work that it took to get to where we are today. And they continue to be changed every single day.
Yes, they do.
Well, this has been my treat and all of our listeners' treat. Marguerite, thank you so much for taking some time of your personal day away and sharing it with us. Your story is phenomenal, is probably the best word I could choose. And we really all appreciate and owe you for all the services that you provided to patients as well as the eye care professions. Thank you again.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.